Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome to the Free Speech Zone.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. This evening, I'm going to see...
You don't know the power of the dark side.
I'm going to see the Dark Prince, Karl Rove, speaking here in Portland. It should be entertaining. I'll fill you in on it on Monday. Anyhow, it's the first hour of our Friday program, and as we've been doing for 3 years more, like going on a little more than 3 years here, Senator Bernie Sanders with us, answering your questions, taking your calls, and responding to you, our sort of town hall of the nation. I think of Bernie Sanders as America's senator. He's not a Democrat or Republican. He's an independent, and the founder of the Progressive Caucus in the House of Representatives, a great progressive member of the United States Senate. Our Brunch with Bernie segment. Senator Bernie Sanders, welcome to the program.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Great to have you here. Bill McKibben was on our show last week. I know that he's a mutual friend of ours. He started this effort to, he's got things going on in cities all over the country. Let you talk about it.
Well, Bill McKibben teaches at Middlebury College here in Vermont. He is an American hero in the sense of really discussing in English the crisis of global warming and what we can do about it. And what he has done, which is exactly what needs to be done in so many areas, is putting together a strong grassroots effort to put pressure on Congress to pass the kind of legislation that we need to reverse global warming and save our planet. And he has helped organize many, many hundreds. I think it's over 1,000 now. Step It Up rallies. I know they're going to be taking place all over the state of Vermont tomorrow. I'm going to be speaking at 4 of them in Vermont, taking place all over this country. And it is exactly the right thing to do. We've got to pressure Congress to act boldly. We have introduced, as I've mentioned before, I think the strongest legislation in the Congress, the Reverse Global Warming. Barbara Boxer and I did that. It's S-309. It would reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 80% by the year 2050, move us away from fossil fuels, move us to energy efficiency, move us to sustainable energy. And by putting pressure on Congress to move in that direction, we can have a real impact on future policy.
Yeah, and their website for people who want to check it out is stepitup07.org.
And they can learn about rallies taking place all over this country. Yeah.
Now, also Iraq is on a lot of people's
minds. Well, obviously, Iraq remains on people's minds. And, you know, to me, it's almost, because we deal with it every day, it's almost beyond the political issue. It is so horrendously depressing. And the damage being done by President Bush and Cheney and the gentleman you're going to be seeing tomorrow, is that Mr. Rove?
Tonight, yeah.
Tonight is going to take us God knows how many years to repair. I am supporting legislation put forward by Senator Feingold and supported by Senator Reid, the leader of the Senate, which would get our troops out completely by a year, start getting them out within the next few months, using the power of the purse to do that, not allow funding for our troops to stay in Iraq except for very, very explicit purposes. And I think that is what we have got to do. We are making a bad situation worse. The Iraqi people, I think, have made it pretty clear that in the midst of all of the chaos, all of the destruction, and you're looking at a nation in disintegration, they feel that they would be safer without our troops there. Our position in terms of our standing in the whole world has declined so much as a result of Bush's action. We have just an enormous amount of work to be done to restore our place, our leadership position in the world, and doing all the things that have to be done, and in fact, intelligently fighting international terrorism, which we're certainly not doing right now. So that's an issue that's out there. I think the good news, that there is more and more sentiment in the Senate now, and I think you may begin to see in the not too far future a number of Republicans just beginning to say, Mr. President, we cannot continue to support this disastrous policy. We're breaking ranks with you. And when that happens, to any significant degree, the war ends.
I have a question. I mean, you understand politics far better than I. You're in the midst of it. My understanding is that in the Constitution, when it says that one of the jobs of the President of the United States is to be Commander-in-Chief of the Navy and the Militia of the United States, that means that he is the commander-in-chief of the military. Why is the Bush administration looking for a war czar? Why are they looking to outsource the job of commander-in-chief?
Well, I mean, they would argue that that's just a technique to make them more effective. The president has the right to appoint generals and secretaries of defense and so forth. But I think, you know, Tom, history will indicate that from day one, which was certainly before 9/11 when they intended to get rid of Saddam Hussein, to their incredibly poor planning for the war, their expectation that we would be greeted as liberators, get our troops out within a few months, their inability to know what to do now, they're not reaching out to other countries in the area or around the world, the isolation that we now feel, this has just been a horrendous disaster. And it is going to take us many, many years to repair that damage and to do what we have to do to help bring stability to this world. And in fact, intelligently, along with the rest of the industrialized world, the rest of the world, intelligently fight international terrorism.
Yeah, it seems to me like Bush is just looking for a front man to take the blame and the flak. He had, you know, he had Rumsfeld for a while, and now he doesn't, you know, to take the blame for it.
Yeah, but I think the other part of the politics is that he wants to keep the troops there so long as he is president.
Yeah.
So that it will never be tacked on to him that he, quote-unquote, lost Iraq or lost the war.
Yeah.
And that's pretty pathetic. But
yeah. Let's talk about the economy a little bit. This is one of the issues that you're very involved with in the Senate.
Well, in the economy, what is happening now is you're going to see some action coming up soon on so-called fast track, which is the authority that Congress has delegated against my vote to give the President of the United States the ability to negotiate trade agreements and then bring legislation, trade agreements, to the Congress for an up or down vote and kind of exclude Congress from being part of the process in developing that legislation. My overview of the economy, and I think the statistics bear it out, is that you're seeing a shrinking middle class. I don't know if you discussed on the program what happened at Circuit City.
Yes, I did last week.
I mean, this is just a metaphor for what's happening in the economy, the outrage that the CEO of Circuit City can fire 3,400 workers, and their crime is that they have been employed at that company for too long. They're now making $11 or $12 an hour. Why not fire them all, bring in new people, and be able to hire them at closer to the minimum wage? And this is really a metaphor for what's happening in our economy in so many ways. Other areas, of course, is that large corporations throwing American workers out on the street, moving to China, moving to low-wage countries. That's not only with blue-collar jobs, worry about what that means in terms of white-collar information technology jobs, but in terms of trade, one of the results of the election is that our number of us in the Senate and in the House right now who are not intending to go along with the trade policies that we've seen for many, many years, including Clinton and this president. Our view is that trade should work to benefit American workers, poor people around the world, and not just the large corporations and their CEOs who make out like bandits. So you're going to see a lot of action and new thinking in terms of trade. If my guess is that the president is not going to get the fast-track authority that he wants. So
when is the debate scheduled on
that? It will be coming up fairly soon because fast-track expires, if I'm not mistaken, at the end of June. So if it is not reauthorized, there is no fast-track. So.
Yeah, this is really a big issue. I mean, this is something that people should be calling their senators at 202-225-3121 to let them know their opinions on.
Right. It is a huge issue. Trade can be a powerful force for good. It can improve our standard of living. It could help poor people around the world. But right now its primary beneficiary is large multinationals who are playing, who are engaging us in a race to the bottom, which is just absolutely disastrous. There's a lot of stuff that is going on in terms of the economy as well. We're working on legislation to make it easier for workers to be able to join unions. One of the problems that exists in our economy is that fewer and fewer workers are members of unions, and it's not because they don't want to be a part of a union. It's because it is increasingly difficult to form a union, given the power of employers and a National Labor Relations Board, which sides with big business virtually all of the time. So we're now holding hearings, and I think a bill will be on the floor of the Senate. It passed the House already, which will give workers who have signed a majority of whom have signed a union card to, in fact, have a union and to move forward to negotiating a first contract.
Yeah, and let's hope that one passes. Yeah. Senator Bernie Sanders is with us. He's taking your calls. Our telephone number, 866-303-2270. You can drop by our live chat room at tomhartmann.com or airamerica.com. It's 16 minutes past the hour in our Brunch with Bernie segment.
This is the Tom Hartmann Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio. This is Tom Hartmann on AirAmericaRadio.com.
It's our Brunch with Bernie hour, the first hour of our Friday program. Senator Bernie Sanders with us answering your questions. Chris in Carson City, or Carson, California, listening to us on K-Talk. You're live with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Thank you very much, Tom. And Senator Sanders, I think you're a patriot. Thank you very much for the work that you do.
Thank you, Chris.
I'm going to ask a question, and this is not... focused on you at all in this question, but are Americans being shortchanged when, in order to get elected, politicians will say anything they think you want to hear, but once in office, they spend 80% of the time dialing for dollars and not diligently representing us? Why is it that only captains of industry, the very wealthy, appear to be the only candidates that assume office? Is this saying that those of us on the bottom or the middle need not apply? Also, will you tell us what the Telecommunications Act of 1996 means to we the people and to the corporations that have usurped the power here, usurped our power here in America?
Okay, Chris, you asked two very, very important questions. I don't know that elected officials in Washington spend 80% of their time raising money, but I can tell you they spend a hell of a lot of money. I can tell you that every day after work, there are people who go down to the Democratic Party headquarters, the Republican Party headquarters, and they do what they call dialing for dollars. And they have long lists in front of them, and they make telephone calls, and they're raising money. And they need to raise more and more and more money as campaigns become more expensive. I think you can talk to Democrats, Republicans, progressives, conservatives, and they will tell you that they are sick and tired of this, that this system is really pathetic and it is stupid, and that the major beneficiaries of it are the big money interests, and those corporations whose executives can make very large corporations and all of these big PACs out there as well. There's a study that came out recently which showed, to nobody's surprise, that many of these corporate-related PACs representing corporate interest, dominated the amount of money that PACs raised and spent. Groups like organized labor and environmental groups were very, very far behind. So the answer to your question, Chris, this is a profoundly important question, because day after day, what happens in Washington and in state capitals is that the needs of the wealthy, the powerful, the large corporations get addressed. The needs of working families do not. Bottom line is, we need a radical change in how we finance campaigns in America, and that means, to my mind, public funding of elections. We're seeing some good steps forward in some states in this country. Arizona, Maine, Connecticut, I think, is moving in that direction. We've got to get that to Washington, D.C., and I'm on legislation that would do that. But, Tom, this is an example where we need strong grassroots effort to break this horrendous catch-22 by which members of Congress have got to hustle money from powerful special interests. In terms of the Telecommunications Act of 96, which I voted against, it's another very big issue. Very briefly, some of the manifestations of it is that radio was deregulated, and what we're seeing in terms of radio is, in some instances, media conglomerates are owning. Tom, you help me out here. How many stations does Clear Channel own?
I don't. It's over 1,000. I don't know, Bernie.
It's over 1,000. We're seeing the loss of locally owned, family owned radio in America. There are many communities that no longer have local news, for example, to cover what the city council, the school board is doing. Very serious problem. We're also deregulated cable TV, which means that the price of cable has soared, among other things.
This is more than just Clear Channel. I mean, this
absolutely, right. We're seeing
there's no one evil corporation here. This is about the rules.
And that, you know, is part of the whole process which we are working on. It's a huge issue of fewer and fewer large media conglomerates owning radio, owning television, owning newspapers, magazines, and controlling what the American people see, hear, read. This is a huge issue, which, needless to say, from the media, from the corporate media, does not get the kind of discussion that it should. But if you want to talk about how we got into Iraq, it's easy enough to blame the stupidity of the Bush administration. But you also have to look at the complicity of the media that acted as a megaphone for the president rather than as a critical voice for the American people. Why it is that we focus on certain issues. Anna Nicole Smith and Britney Spears, my goodness, you can get all the information. It never ends with this Anna Nicole Smith. They're still going on with her. And yet why the middle class is declining, why poverty is increasing. If you go to Google and look how much discussion there was on Anna Nicole Smith as opposed to an increase in poverty in America, let me tell you, Anna Nicole Smith will win that that comparison. So yeah, those are very important issues.
To some extent, this also goes back to Reagan in 1982, stopping enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act, which is still on the books.
Absolutely correct. And that's an issue we are taking a very hard look at right now.
Yeah, and this explosion of mergers and acquisitions and Michael Milken's, who came out of that, you know, the roaring 80s, which was just the result of him saying it's fine if corporations get bigger and bigger and bigger and buy each other and everything else. So.
Right.
Anyhow, it's Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls. Pardon my going off on a rant here. This is your hour. Taking your calls here on the Tom Hartman Program, 866-303-2270. Our telephone number if you want to drop into our live chat room. Drop by TomHartman.com. Click live chat right up at the top of the page. Or you can go to AirAmerica.com and link through to it as well. 27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio. The Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
It's all good. It's all right.
Yeah, let's not complain. Let's just get out there and get active. Become activists. Get involved. Participate. Show up. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour. Brunch with Bernie. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. Frank in Middletown, New York. You're live with Senator Sanders.
Oh, hi. My name is Frank, and I'd like to ask a question to the Senator because I think he's uniquely qualified to perhaps to answer it as the only real independent in the Senate. We have a president who almost considers himself a dictator, and one of the reasons for that is because even after the change of control in the House and Senate, he's still veto-proof. I know that there are obviously 30 senators coming up next year and all the House members. Are there enough of them who are vulnerable enough that have to start paying attention to their local electorate rather than the president to eventually create the ability to override this man's vetoes?
Frank, well, obviously in 2008 we have a presidential election coming up as well. But right now, your question is a very good question. And what you're seeing is that people like Gordon Smith of the state of Oregon suddenly beginning to change his views on the war. You're seeing Chuck Hagel in Nebraska being stronger on this war. You're seeing a number of other Republicans who are increasingly uncomfortable about having to defend the president in this disastrous war. So to answer your question, the answer is yes. I think there's a lot of softness on the part of a number of Republicans in the House and the Senate. I think if we can produce strong grassroots activity around the country, we can reach the day where a number of these Republicans will walk into the White House and say, we've had enough with your failed policies.
Chris in Dublin, California, listening on The Quake. You're live with Bernie Sanders.
Oh, thanks for taking my call. It's always nice to be on the show, Tom. It's a real privilege to speak to you, Senator Sanders.
Thank you.
Let me start off. I have a bunch of things, but I'll try and keep it short. First, I want to start off and give my congratulations to the people of Vermont, because I think they've got something really special going on with two incredible statesmen representing in the United States Senate. And that's coming from someone who has Feinstein and Boxer, so it's a pretty good compliment. There seems like there's so much going on. There's so much corruption and so much stuff that's gone on with this administration that is so contrary to the nature of the Constitution that, to me, as a casual observer and as a regular layman American person, and maybe I would suspect to a lot of people, that this whole process seems to be really moving kind of slowly with bringing this administration to account. And I was wondering, I wanted to get your sense of what you feel that your fellow senators, how they feel. Is it that they're just trying to be civil about this, or do you think that your fellow senators really understand how frustrated and outraged the American people are?
That's an excellent question, and believe me, we talk about that quite often. And to answer your question honestly, I think some do, some don't. But this is what you also have to understand, that in the last 100 days or so, three and a half months, think about what's happening now in the House and the Senate compared to what was happening before. You are complimentary about my colleague, Senator Leahy, who is chairman of the Judiciary Committee, who is in the process of subpoenaing a number of Bush administration people with regard to this U.S. attorney business. You're looking now at investigations with regard to how we got in the war, the conduct of the war. You're looking at investigations regarding no-bid contracts. Henry Waxman in the House is doing a great job in a whole lot of areas. This has only been 3.5 months. So in one sense, there are things happening, not as fast as we would like them. The second point that I want to make, Chris, is that, and a lot of people don't fully appreciate this, I share the frustration, trust me, that we are not moving faster on health care, on tax reform, on the war in Iraq, on global warming, all of these issues. But we have to understand that in the nature of the Senate, it takes 60 votes. It takes a cloture vote in order to get things moving. And all you need is the Republicans saying, sorry, we don't want to bring this issue to a vote. We're here to talk and talk and talk. Nothing happens. So it is very frustrating in terms of how slow things move. I think if you look at the last 3.5 months, there have been some good changes, but clearly we have got to step it up, and clearly we've got to get rid of a number of people who see their function in Congress as to represent the wealthy and large corporations who are reactionary, and we've got to get rid of them.
Al in Los Altos, California. Al, you're live with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. I am a World War II vet, and one of the things that concerns me the most during all these investigations is that Halliburton has suddenly decided they're going to move everything into Dubai. Does this mean that they will escape all investigations and all confiscation of their records as far as the government contracting they've had in Iraq?
Al, thank you very much for asking that excellent question. And the answer, if I have anything to say with it, is absolutely not a big N-O. Think of the outrage here. I mean, and Al put his finger right on it. Here you have a corporation that was headed by the current Vice President of the United States of America. Here you have a corporation that has made billions in no-bid contracts. And then what they say to the American people is, oh, by the way, we're moving to Dubai, so perhaps we don't have to pay American taxes, or perhaps we can avoid answering some of the questions that the American people want asked. It is an outrage. But to answer Al's question, no, we're going to ask the right questions, and we're going to get the right answers to many of their outrageous practices.
David in San Francisco, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Oh, hi, Senator and Tom. I wanted to ask you a question about the Iraqi oil bill that's floating, as I understand it, in the Iraqi legislature. They're trying to pass a bill which is going to allow America and the giant oil companies to loot them. I think it's a, what is it, 75-25 split where the Iraqis get 25%. And it crosses my mind that with this green zone bombing that happened yesterday, is there any way of, first of all, tracking whether or not those legislators who were killed were going to vote either way on that bill, or I'm just wondering whether it was the death was more related to how voting went as opposed to Al Qaeda, who claimed.
I would say, Dave, that's I wouldn't look at it that way. I mean, I think the story of the bombing is the ability of Al Qaeda, whoever it was, to gain entry into a highly protected enclave. I think that's the story there, and it tells
us. It's the problem of being an imperial occupier.
Right.
You know, I mean, eventually the people just say enough already.
And that speaks to our overall flawed policy in Iraq.
Yeah. Ernie in Brooklyn, New York, you're live with Senator Bernie Sanders.
How you doing, gentlemen?
Good.
If we have occupied and overthrew the Iraqi government, and then we hire the Iraqi soldiers, we train 300,000 of them, and if this administration is talking about attacking Iran, where do the loyalties of these 300,000 Iraqi soldiers, who would be loyal to? And I'll just hang up and let you get your answer.
Well, obviously, Ernie, many of us throughout our country and many of us in the Congress think it would be a disaster for the United States, or for the Bush administration, more likely, to wage a preemptive attack on Iran. And I have introduced legislation, as have others, to make it crystal clear that before the president ever thought about doing that, he would have to get authority from the Congress, which I believe he would not get. You asked the question about the allegiance of people, Shiites, in terms of a war with Iraq and a war with Iran, and that is a very good question, probably one among many other things that the Bush administration hasn't thought much about.
Yeah, tragically. Scott in Utah, you're live with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Senator. I have a question regarding signing statements versus the presidential veto.
Right.
In the past, George Bush has issued signing statements saying that he can disregard parts of legislation he does not care for. In this instance, he is going to issue a veto of the troop funding bill because it has timelines on it. Now, if, in fact, the presidential signing statement was a legitimate way of doing business, why wouldn't he continue and just make a signing statement? I mean, he's making a tacit admission that the signing statements are not the way to handle business.
Well, these signing statements, and the number of them done by the Bush administration, are a complete outrage. They are unconstitutional to my mind, and I think that's another area that you're going to see congressional committees take a look at. The president has the right to veto. He has the right to sign, but he does not have the right to pick and choose what sections of the bill he wants to enforce. He can't do that. So this is an issue that must be looked at very closely.
45 minutes past the hour. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. Our Brunch with Bernie hour. Senator Bernie Sanders, independent member of the House of the United States Senate from Vermont. Our number 866-303-2270, TomHartmann.com, AirAmerica.com. Going to drop into our live chat room. We'll be right back.
Listening to the Tom Hartmann Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio.
In olden days, a glimpse of stocking was looked on as something shocking. Now heaven knows, anything goes. Good authors, too, who once knew better words, now only use fallen.
Nine and a half minutes before the hour, Tom Hartmann with you. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour. Senator Bernie Sanders answering your questions. And John in Mount Pleasant, Pennsylvania, you're live with Senator Sanders.
Hello, Tom, and hello, Bernie. I just want to ask a question. I keep getting literature in the mail from the office of the chairman of the National Notch Victim Society.
The National what?
Notch Victim Society. People who were born between 1917 and 1926. They're trying to get more money out of their Social Security. Do you know anything about that bill?
Yeah, I do. There's been a lot of debate about this for many, many years. I think what you will find, John, is that most of the national senior and reputable senior citizen organizations do not believe that, in fact, what these letters are saying is true, or believe that that group of people have been shortchanged. So I would toss the letter into the garbage can.
Janice in Long Beach, California. You're live with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hello. It's a privilege to be with Senator Sanders and Mr. Hartman. My question is, I'm trying to voice a fear that many of us have. When you connect the dots, there are so many corruptions of our constitutional rights, the Military Commissions Act, et cetera, et cetera. And it seems that this administration is keeping our troops, our legitimate military, out of the country and out of the way for more and more prolonged periods. And what really is most bone-chilling to me is this, you put that together with the rise in numbers and power of these of Bush's private army like Blackwater. And even Cheney, when he addressed some group, mentioned a few weeks ago that the amendment should be suspended about a third
that
term.
That was Janice,
office.
Actually, an April Fool's joke.
Oh, okay.
I
wonder if the Military Commissions Act, could they put down the public and maybe there won't be an election?
Okay. I think, as I have said many, many times, I happen to believe that the Bush administration will go down as one of the worst, if not the worst, administration in the history of our country. On the other hand, it doesn't do anybody any good to become paranoid and think that elections are going to be suspended. I know during, Tom, you'll remember, I'm sure you got many calls during the 2006 election that why vote? Because Karl Rove has his finger on the button and the Republicans will win all the close elections and, in fact, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So paranoia is just because, you know, there are enormous problems facing our country. Paranoia is not going to help. We're going to do grassroots organizing, focus on the important issues, and elect good people. So, no, I do not think that the military or anybody else is going to prevent an election in 2008. I think we're going to have an election. And, in fact, I'm quite optimistic about this election. I think this election will take us a very far distance away from the right-wing extremism, which has so dominated our country in such a disaster way for so many years. So let's get to work and win the election and not be paranoid about it.
Anna in Brooklyn, New York, you're live with Senator Bernie Sanders. Anna?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, Mr. Senator, do you know anything about Mr. Wolfowitz taking money from the World Bank to give on his girlfriend so she could buy nice things?
Well, I know what I read in the paper, and apparently there's quite a brouhaha going up on quite an investigation. There are calls for his resignation, and we will see what happens.
Tim in Portland, Oregon. You're live with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hi. It's an honor to speak to both of you. My question or my suggestion, it might be simplistic, but I wanted to run it by you both. I think part of the problem is that the average American really doesn't understand how this process works with the separation of the powers and overriding a veto, et cetera. And I just wonder, would it be beneficial to have Democratic leadership get some TV time and say, this is how this works. This is the numbers we have. If you want the troops out of Iraq and you want us to be able to override the veto, then we're going to need you to call your representatives. We're going to need the numbers. And I just feel like, you know, you're the majority party. Would taking some time and really almost teaching the American public how this works?
Tim, that is, I don't think that that is a simple-minded or a simplistic thought. I think it's a very important thought. And I think it sometimes distresses me as I go around the country to see how little people understand about the basic political processes of our country. You talk to kids who do not know how many senators there are. who don't know the name of their senator, don't know the name of their member of Congress. So I think developing an approach, primarily I think in the schools but in the media, which explains to the American people how we make decisions in this country, how they can impact on those decisions, how they can be involved in the political process, is enormously important.
Ralph in Colorado Springs, Colorado. You're live with Bernie Sanders.
Yeah. Senator, thank you for talking to common citizens. Do we need a constitutional amendment to update Congress's war powers? We seem to do this thing the same damn way over and over again.
Well, as you know, that's a good question, Ralph. As you know, toward the end of the Vietnam War, if I'm not mistaken, legislation called the War Powers Act was passed, trying to clarify the role of the Congress in terms of making war, which clearly the Constitution mandates. I don't know that you need a constitutional amendment. The courts have dealt with that to some degree, but essentially, no president should be able to go to war unless there was some kind of emergency situation without the authority of the Congress.
And Bush maybe has talked about, I don't need congressional authority to go into Iran, he said.
Right, which is, to my mind, and some of us have made it very, very clear, both through legislation and in other ways, that that would provoke a huge constitutional crisis.
Yeah. Bernie, real quickly, we've got about 25 seconds here. 33 years ago yesterday, day before yesterday, Congress subpoenaed Nixon for the White House tapes. 5 months later, he was out of office. They're subpoenaing Rove now. You think anything's going to happen?
It will be, to say the least, very interesting and long.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us. This is Air America Radio.
Tom Hartman is excellent. He's bright. He's personable.
Tom Hartman on Air America Radio. Now, Air America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome to the No Boring Zone.
Well, we tried this last Friday, this Anything Goes Friday idea, and it seemed to work pretty well, so we're going to try it for a couple of hours here, the next 2 hours of the program. Anything you want to talk about, any questions you may have, any topics you want to bring up, whether they have to do with politics or not. I mean, you want to talk about health, you want to talk about attention deficit disorder, you want to talk about psychiatry, you want to talk about the weather, well, you know, within reasonable boundaries. Like maybe the origin of the weather as a consequence of global warming. Well, even as I said, even if you want to go beyond just political issues, let's just do a bit of a national town hall here for the next 2 hours and have a conversation. Our number 866-303-2270. You can drop into our live chat room by going to tomhartman.com or airamerica.com and click on the live chat link. Richard in Keyport, New Jersey. Hey, Richard, welcome to the program.
Yes, Tom. Yesterday I was listening to your show, mm-hmm. and my phone rang, and it was my nephew from Vermont. Oh. And he heard in the background the radio, and he said, "Are you listening to Tom Hartman?" I said, "Yeah." He says, "I have his cats." I'm talking about
which
cats? Have his cats. How can you have Tom Hartman's cats? He said, "Well, Tom used to live up here, and when he moved from Vermont to God knows where."
Portland, Oregon.
His wife called and asked if we would take his cats. Is that a fact?
This must be Ann King's significant other. The story, the situation is that we had a cat who was so old and elderly that we were told that if we tried to put her on an airplane to Portland, she would die.
Oh.
And that cat had bonded with a Maine Coon cat that we had, Zippy. Zippy was the old cat, and the Maine Coon cat was Java. And those two had bonded. And then we had three other cats. We had, you know, Mowgli, Boncha, and Higgins, and who were all fine. But those two cats had formed a real pair, and so Ann took Zippy for us, the very elderly cat, and Java, we sent Java along with her to stay in Vermont because Java had so bonded to Zippy, and Louise still misses those cats. We brought the other three with us out here. But we couldn't get Zippy on an airplane. We were the vet was, you know, this cat's like 16 years old, and the vet was like, that cat will die.
Yeah, well, he sent me a picture on the internet of your cat. Zippy, is it?
Zippy is the old one, the old gray one, and then yeah. Java's the big Maine Coon cat that stayed there with him. With her, actually.
But he wasn't pulling my leg.
No, probably not. If he's with Ann, so I guess that's a little off the topic of politics. Thanks for the call, Richard.
In addition to that, I tried the first hour to get that, and the line was busy, busy, busy. I just wanted to relate a message to Senator Frank that Bob said that Bernie Frank is the best thing ever happened to Vermont.
Yeah, Bernie Sanders actually is his name.
To hear that.
Yeah, Bernie Sanders is a good guy, and our greetings to your nephew in Vermont, and thanks for taking good care of the cats we had to leave behind tragically. Michael in Yakima, Washington. Hey, Michael, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Hi. I just had a quick question, and I'm a little ignorant about this, so you might have to fill me in. But I was wondering, I know that the president can call for a red alert, and I was wondering if there's any way...
You mean
that
a state of emergency?
If that has to be confirmed by Congress, or if there's any way that they can try and put forth something that would make it so that if the president did feel that that was necessary, that that would have to be confirmed.
Right. I am by no means an expert on this, and there probably are people out there who are, and if any of them are listening, feel free to call in and set me straight if I've got this wrong. But my understanding of the situation is that there was an executive order during the Nixon era, and there have been a number of laws that have been passed principally surrounding things like FEMA and the creation of FEMA over the years, that have said that in a time of emergency, the president can declare a state of emergency essentially immediately, and that there's a time period thereafter. And I frankly don't recall exactly what it is. My recollection is that it's 90 days, but I may well be wrong on that. That there's a time period after that if that state of emergency, if a total national federal state of emergency is being declared, then Congress has to confirm it. And assuming that Congress is still in existence, I mean, keep in mind, some of these emergency laws go back to the Cold War and the assumption that Washington, D.C. was taken out by a nuke and the president was, you know, under a mountain somewhere in Colorado hiding out. So they envision that. And that it gives the president some considerable powers. And there are many people, oddly enough, most of them on the far right, who are very, very, very concerned about this, and it's a source of unending conversation among the militia, in quotes, community, the very conservative community, the people who are like out in the woods with the shotguns and things and whatnot. But that's my understanding of it, Michael. And as I said, I'm sure more enlightenment will be following. Lyle in Arkansas. Hey, Lyle, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. How are you? I'm a Korean vet. And I just got thinking, during Vietnam, we had the draft.
Yes. And during Korea, for that matter.
Well, yeah, we did in Korea, too. I spent 18 months over there. Mm-hmm. The thing of it is, if they would bring back the draft, the Congress and the Senate would start bringing back the draft and everything, it wouldn't be very much longer before people with BI rate, it would be like the Vietnam era, and Bush would have to do a turnaround before it was made law.
Yeah, I agree with you, Lyle, and I've said that on this program, and I know it makes some people just absolutely crazy that they think that I'm calling for some kind of dictatorship.
Well,
I don't think that we should have a draft the way that we had a draft during World War II or during Korea, though. I think we should have, or during Vietnam, I think we should have an absolute national service, one-year national service requirement after graduation from high school, where you can choose to go into the military, or you can spend a year working in a hospital or with a nonprofit group or the Peace Corps, you know, basically any approved nonprofit group doing good work. And in exchange for that, you get 4 years of free college. And that way we're, number one, we're providing that transition and that rite of passage for young people in our society, you know, getting them out of their you know, local hometown and seeing the world. And number two, we're providing a rationale to provide that kind of social mobility, which comes from 4 years of college or 4 years of a good trade school if they want to go into one of the professions that, you know, one of the trade professions that require education or an apprenticeship for that matter, that we just say, you know, we'll back you for 4 years in learning a skill that will serve you for the rest of your life.
Well, that's right. But there's not enough people, and I heard earlier, too, when you were talking to the senator, there's not enough people in this country that won't or don't pick up their phone and call their representatives.
Yeah. No, absolutely spot on. And it takes an informed and active electorate to get out there and do that. And the telephone number, by the way, for Congress is 202-225-3121. And you can call your senator or your member of the House of Representatives. And what I'm suggesting basically would be like a national service program plus the GI Bill, I guess. Jeff in Burbank, California. Hey, Jeff, welcome to the program.
Hey, good day. I was reading the Los Angeles Times this morning. They talked about this Corzine accident a little bit, and then I just heard on your break news about this Corzine accident. And my question is, why haven't we heard yet the full obvious details of the accident, such as did he hit a tree, or did the other person in the other car get hurt, or did the passengers in his car get hurt?
Apparently, I've been reading the news reports here. In fact, I just got the most recent one. Corzine was the one who was severely injured. His driver and the other guy, who I'm assuming were in the front seat, a state trooper and an aide, were mildly injured. He was not wearing a seatbelt. They both were. That should tell you something. There was a white pickup truck that was involved that apparently ran them off the road, and they hit a guardrail. And they're still looking for the white pickup truck, and I'm guessing that John Corzine, when he recovers from this thing, is going to start wearing his seatbelt with some regularity. I mean, this should be an object lesson for the entire nation. But I think a lot of people sitting in the back seat of cars, I mean, you know, I take taxis all the time, and you just, you know, when I travel, and you just don't think to put on a seatbelt in the back seat of a car where you know, you get that kind of taxi feeling, you know what I mean?
Like a limousine.
Yeah, well, and I'm guessing that's what this was. It was probably a Lincoln Town Car or something like that, that, you know, he had a trooper and a guy driving, and he's sitting in the back, you know, going through papers or whatever, and probably hadn't bothered to put his seatbelt on. Now, that part of the information, I'm just guessing, although we do know that he didn't have a seatbelt on. So, you know, John Corzine provides us all with an object lesson. John, thanks a lot for the call. 16 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you.
Truth in broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
In olden days, a glimpse of stocking was looked on.
It's our Anything Goes Friday. David and I sitting here drinking our hemp milk. I kid you not. Living Harvest, this is a Portland, Oregon company, and they've just come out with the world's first hemp milk with a nice little leaf logo on the cover, Living Harvest hemp milk. And what's amazing is a glass of this stuff contains 900 milligrams of omega-3s and 2,800 milligrams of omega-6s. This is like drinking fish oil in terms of the fatty acids that you need to make your brain work and your heart work. I'm really impressed. I just, you know, tip of the hat to, they're not an advertiser or anything. I'm just telling you about this. This is to Living Heart at Harvest. And Julian says, how do you get milk from hemp? You milk it very carefully. No, it's the seeds. They crush the seeds up. It's like rice milk or soy milk. You know, they just crush the seeds. In fact, that's the ingredients here. The ingredients list, filtered water, whole hemp nut, shelled hemp seeds, brown rice syrup, natural vanilla, and other natural flavors. And then there's, you know, calcium phosphate, a little calcium and a little vitamin A and some vitamin D12 and B12, and that's it. I mean, it's cool stuff. And they're selling it in local health food stores here. So anyhow, watch out for the hemp milk out there. I mean, as in look for it. This is This is cool stuff. It's our Anything Goes Friday, taking your calls in the order in which they are arriving here. Terry in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Terry, welcome to the program.
Oh, hello. Am I on?
You are, and thanks for listening to us here on KPOJ.
Oh, Tom, great. My concern, I call my congressman about this quite often, but it's the military-industrial complex and, what Eisenhower warned us about. And, of course, we didn't take heed his advice, obviously. But anyway, what I'm concerned about is who in Congress is making money on our military-industrial complex, whether it be stocks, bonds, companies they own, companies their spouses own. Cheney made $500 million off of this very system, and yet we can't provide proper body armor all the time, blah, blah, blah. The system needs to be shut down. Every time there's a base closing, there's protests, thousands of civilian military jobs lost, and we spend more than anybody in the rest of the world, more than the rest of the world combined on the military-industrial complex.
My understanding, Terry, is that members of Congress and members of the executive branch who are decision-makers, that would be the president and vice president, I think probably largely and specifically, are required by law to either not vote on issues that might affect industries or companies in which they are invested, or to get around that, they put their money in blind trusts so that they don't have access to it. And if anybody is violating that, that's something that U.S. attorneys should go after. Not that any in the Bush administration would ever consider doing that, but it's certainly what they should be considering doing. Evan in Durham, North Carolina. Hey, Evan, welcome to the program.
Great. Yeah. I love. Senator Sanders does great work and everything, but to be honest, when you asked him about this war czar issue, to me, he seemed to kind of skirt that question. And
well, I think
I'm
it's new to a lot of members of the Senate. They're trying to figure out what Bush is talking about.
I don't see what to me, this is pretty straightforward. We don't need, and B, he can't appoint someone to be some sort of super commander-in-chief of some sort.
I agree. Although I suppose he could appoint anybody to have any position that he wants if they don't have specific authority and they're not a constitutional officer. I mean, the Constitution says that if he's appointing an actual constitutional officer, then it has to be confirmed by the Senate. My guess is what he's looking for is somebody who's going to be essentially a figurehead. By the way, just an interesting little piece of news on this. It was Newt Gingrich who first proposed this idea. Therefore, you get it that there's some politics involved here, probably more than just a little bit. Neil in Eugene, Oregon. Hey, Neil.
Yeah, hi. Tom, this was also a comment for Senator Sanders, and it's in line with this last caller about him avoiding certain issues. It's my understanding that when the Democrats took control of the Congress, they also, one of the major advantages is they get to really set the agenda, the legislative agenda. When the Republicans were in control of the Congress, the excuse was, well, we can't get our legislation put forward because they control what gets forward. Now it seems he's making the same excuse, blaming the Republicans for the fact that the agenda isn't going as fast as
points. The first, and again, I don't want to be speaking on behalf of Bernie Sanders. I'll speak on behalf of myself. Number
right.
one, the Democrats have been in charge of the House and Senate for 100 days. Today is the 100th day, literally.
Right.
And in those 100 days, they have passed all kinds of things, including stem cell legislation. I mean, there's just been this whole variety of things. They have initiated a series of investigations. I mean, it's really quite extraordinary when you consider all the things that they have done. The point in the Senate that Bernie was speaking to is that it takes 60 votes in the Senate to get past a filibuster, and it takes 67 votes in the Senate to get past a presidential veto.
Uh-huh.
And that's, unlike the House, in the House you've got to have a veto-proof majority too, but in an absolute majority can pass something in the House, whereas in the Senate it takes 60 out of 100, 6/10.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
It's our Anything Goes Friday. Tom Hartman here with you. The folks in the chat room yesterday pointing out to me that it was the anniversary of the death of Franklin Roosevelt. It's today is the anniversary of the birth of Thomas Jefferson. In the next hour, I'm going to share a quote from Thomas Jefferson with you. In this hour, before we go back to your calls, just a couple of very, very short clips from Franklin Roosevelt in the memory of one of the, arguably one of the three or four greatest presidents in the history of the United States.
I see one third of a nation ill-housed, ill-clad, ill-nourished.
And he did something about it. He created the second great American middle class.
Let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror which paralyzes needed efforts to convert retreat into advance.
And once again, Bush is trying to use that terror card to terrorize us. You must be afraid. If we don't fight them over there, they're going to get on United Airlines or maybe American or maybe Acme Airlines and fly over here. And come on. And Roosevelt.
We're not a warlike people. We've never sought glory as a nation of warriors. We're not interested in aggression. We are not interested, as the dictators are, in looting. We do not covet one square inch of the territory of any other nation.
It's been a long time since Roosevelt said those words, and Americans held that value right up and still hold that value. Just George Bush and his administration don't. And finally, Roosevelt calling his generation to arms, to action, really the same way that we are collectively calling ourselves to action now, and some of our political leaders are beginning to get with it.
There is a mysterious cycle in human events. To some generations, much is given. Of other generations, much is expected. This generation of Americans has a rendezvous with destiny.
Jerry in Long Island, New York. You're live and on the air, Jerry.
Yeah, thanks very much. Thanks very much for taking my call. Yeah, first of all, I agree with you, Tom. I strongly suspect this whole U.S. attorney purge scandal does go all the way up to Bush himself, like you've expressed in the past. And that's why I so strongly agree with the New York Times March 31st editorial. It's what's really needed here is sworn public testimony by Karl Rove and everyone else involved. And I think one of the main reasons that people like Karl Rove want to avoid giving testimony under an oath to tell the truth and a penalty of perjury is because they know they have only two choices, to tell the truth and to implicate their boss, or to lie and go to jail for perjury. And that's why I think it's so important that congressional Democrats do not cave in and compromise on this issue.
Absolutely, Jerry. Very, very well said. Absolutely spot on. Mary in San Jose, California. Hey, Mary.
Tom, I'm very happy that you're taking my call, and we so enjoyed your visit to Redwood City a few weeks ago.
Oh, thank you. That was a lot of fun.
Oh, that was fun. I hope you come back again. My concern is about our veterans being screwed again by a little publicized issue. I read an article in the Nation magazine about some of our veterans who have sustained head injuries or post-traumatic stress disorder, and they're being pressured to accept a discharge under Regulation 635-200.
Yes, we've talked about that on this program with Larry Scott from VAWatchdog.org.
I'm so concerned about this. This is called separation because of personality disorder.
Right. They are redefining a lot of these vets. They're saying, oh, you have a personality disorder, therefore it's a pre-existing condition, therefore you're not eligible for Veterans Administration health benefits. And it's an absolute crime.
Or disability pay.
Right, or disability pay, absolutely. And it's an absolute crime, Mary, and it is, again, the Bush administration saying that George W. Bush wants to use our soldiers as photo op props, but he has no interest in helping them or serving them after they come back from this war of aggression that he began on a pack of lies. John in Portland, Oregon, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Hi, Tom. I am sort of concerned about the fairness doctrine, as I'm sure many people are. It seems that every time there is somebody that disagrees with the radical right, they call them a liberal, no matter where they are on the spectrum.
Oh, yeah, and now you've got guys on the talking points on the right now, or let's try and trash Keith Olbermann and take him down. They took down Imus. Let's see if we can figure out a way to take down Keith Olbermann. How dare there be somebody on television who's not a right winger? I mean, I wouldn't even say that Olbermann may well be a liberal. I wouldn't say that his program is a liberal program. I'd say he's running down the middle and frankly, right down the American middle. I mean, you know, it's just very straightforward stuff. With regard to a fairness doctrine, though, John, I think it's really important to be very, very careful with this. I was in radio during the old fairness doctrine, and what it did was it caused us simply not to do politics, because you were always afraid that somebody in the government was going to decide whether you had gone too far to the left or too far to the right. I think that instead what we need is a modern version of the fairness doctrine, which is called programming in the public interest, which is to say that if you're a running radio or television station, you have an obligation to use those airwaves in a way that serves the public interest, and that means reflecting all political viewpoints. But be very, very, let's be very, very careful about handing the power to say, oh, you didn't have enough conservatives on, therefore, or you didn't have enough liberals on, to anybody in government, because keep in mind, government may be run by people, you know, on, you know, good guys, and it may be run by bad guys. I mean, would you want the Bush administration right now determining what should be being programmed on radio? I suppose to some extent they are, but I'd be very wary of that. Bob in New York City. Bob, welcome to the program.
How you doing, Tom? I do appreciate your opinions all the time, and I know it's all Anything Goes Friday, and I'm going to throw this out to you. Because of the popularity of the movie 300 and Thermopylae, the battle of Thermopylae coming to the surface again, its role in the survival of Western civilization, democracy to be specific.
Mm-hmm.
This was the first time on the planet that people could vote, and as a consequence, were able to move through traditional class strata.
You're talking about the first Greek democracy, what, 3,200 years ago or thereabouts?
Yeah. And how the Persians threatened them, and then Greece survived, and so did democracy.
Yeah.
I'm wondering who, if you were to draw parallels, or who or what could be today's Persians that threaten that the whole idea of democracy and being able to transcend your class strata that you're born into?
The followers of Leo Strauss.
Yeah.
I would say the largest threat to democracy around the world right now are the neocons. They're the people who believe that the ends justify the means, that it's entirely appropriate to lie to people to accomplish your goals, that war will bring peace, that war will solve all problems, that religion should be used as a way as a tool for political manipulation, that religion should be incorporated into government and government into religion so that you can make sure that it is used as a tool of corporate governance, and that ultimately you want to have single party rule in a nation and in order to maintain power. And it's all based on the idea, and this is an old conservative idea, I mean, this goes back a long, long time, it's all based on the idea that people are fundamentally flawed and fundamentally evil, and therefore you can't have peace unless you have an absolute ruling class and an absolute and essentially absolute power, and not just in one country but worldwide. And that's the worldview that was brought to us by Leo Strauss and the neocons. That's the Paul Wolfowitz, Doug Feith, Don Rumsfeld, Dick Cheney worldview. I don't think Bush is frankly sophisticated enough to understand it. I think he just loves the idea of raw power. You know, his joke about this would be great if it was a dictatorship, just as long as I'm the dictator. I think that's about the limit of his understanding of it. But I think that your analogy is a good one. Cheryl in Santa Cruz, California. Hey, Cheryl.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm calling in regards to a conversation that you had about gifted kids.
Mm-hmm.
A few days ago, and about how the gifted kids were not getting a fair shake. And I'm coming from the perspective, as I grew up in Detroit and subsidizing housing from a single mom, and I was able to go to college because of student loans, and now own two houses and have my master's and becoming a lawyer. So
good on you.
I feel like I'm one of the rare or unusual people who really do pull them who've had an opportunity through social programs to bring myself out of the class I was born in. But
mm-hmm.
recently I had an experience where I lived on a very, very wealthy block in Santa Barbara, California, and lived in a school district called Washington, the school, elementary school. And in that school, they're using the gifted program called GATE, as a backdoor to segregation. They have these tests that these kids have to take in the second grade where you have these families that live in mansions on one salary, doctors, lawyers, very wealthy people, spending $1,000 to teach their second graders how to pass the GATE test, for which minorities can't pass and people without means can't afford, and that in 1 year, in 2004, this learning center got hold of the actual GATE test, and an entire second grade at Washington got admitted to GATE.
Yeah, see, that's the problem with any kind of standardized testing, Cheryl, is that, you know, giftedness is not, there are people who are musically
but
gifted,
I don't think it's a matter, I disagree, it's not a matter of standardized testing, it's a matter of that school having a GATE program where only white kids who pass that test are in this program, and they're not truly GATE, where the parents are paying for their kids to prepare. And as a middle-class person, I object to my tax dollars being used for the doctor, lawyer, rich people's kids getting an education because they could afford
to prepare their
kids.
So do I, Cheryl. So do I. You know, speaking as the son of a guy who worked at a tool and die shop, so do I. 45 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio.
It's Anything Goes Friday. Tom Hartman here with you. By the way, this Sunday, day after tomorrow, April 15th, at 4 p.m., I'll be in Phoenix, Arizona, for the first anniversary party of 1480 KPHX. So join me and a few other progressive talk show hosts and 1,500 of our closest friends to celebrate the first year on the air of Progressive Talk Radio. Hang out with us, the staff, federal progressives, and all that kind of thing. You can find all the details at 1480kphx.com. Check it out. Michael in Los Angeles, California. Hey, Michael, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on. So I was looking at the top 10 issues that Republicans should be campaigning on, but I went through them and I thought, well, you know, they could campaign on values, but you got to look at Gingrich's $350,000 fine to Nancy Pelosi as the head of the Ethics Committee, or the torture. Maybe we could talk about the Reagan mantle of less government intrusion into people's lives, but we've got the Patriot Act and the ripping of the Constitution. We could talk two words we haven't heard in 6 years, fiscal conservatives, so we can't campaign on that. Maybe we could talk about compassionate conservatism, Ann Coulter, Abu Ghraib, national security, drop the ball on 9/11, Iraq, maybe the wage gap, free trade, can't talk about that, can't talk about health care, can't talk about the environment, can't talk about privatizing Social Security, can't talk about energy policy because that's done in secret. I mean, you pick an issue. These people are on the diametrically wrong side of the issue, on the side of history. Now, there's even if the Democrats didn't spend a dime, they should still be able to run these people out of town on a rail because it is that bad.
Yeah, very well said, Michael. Thank you for the list and spot on. Tony in Booton, New Jersey. Hey, Tony.
A pleasure talking to you, Tom.
Thanks for calling, Tony. What's up?
I want to use a Freudian template to maybe overlay the Constitution of the United States and tell me if you agree with me. The three concepts of the id, the ego, and the superego, you understand those principles, right?
Sure, and you're suggesting that the id is the executive branch, or actually probably the ego would be the executive branch. The superego would be what, the Supreme Court and the id would be, see, the id, you know, Freud described the id as a seething cauldron of primal instinct. I'm not sure
the id would be the executive because it's just will. It has no conscience, and the ego would be.
Oh, in this case, yeah.
Okay, so now let me go to one other concept, an Aristotelian idea of the unities of time, the past, the present, and the future.
Right.
The id would like to live in the present all the time because it has no regard for what it has done or what it's going to do.
Well, in Freudian terms, the id does live in the present in all the times.
It doesn't have a
concept of past or future.
The
superego, you know, hesitates you in the future. The ego draws in the past and also, you know, lives for the future. But it's
well,
keeping
let
you go.
Me give you my presentation, and then you
sure.
can agree with me.
Okay. If you can do it quickly, please.
Act through will, without thought. The past is the ego, which is reactionary. The present tense would be the future, which is the superego because it tries to avoid what could occur. So one overreacts, one kind of examines and tries to find out what it did wrong. And the government, the way it's set up right now, either one of them, if it's got too much power, corrupts the other two. So I think we're living in a state of id-ego, like a Nietzschean philosophy.
Yeah, no, you may well be right, Tony. You may spot on well be right. I don't know. It's an interesting metaphor. I frankly think that, you know, Freud has been supplanted by more modern theories that make more sense. But interesting concept. Deep Blue in Reno, Nevada. Hey, Deep Blue, what's up?
Hey, how's it going, Tom?
Great. And thank you for listening, by the way, on KJFK.
KJFK. I'm actually a original born and raised resident of the People's Republic of Little Beirut.
Oh, so, Portland, Oregon. Yeah, cool.
Yeah. What's up? And so I'm kind of transplanted here. And you remember that Social Security email that you debunked using Snopes a couple of days ago?
Yeah.
Yeah, the talk full of those talking points. Well, yesterday, a Reno talk show host by the name of Bill Manders, a conservative Rush clone, basically, started spouting off talking points off that list. And so I felt that it was my duty to call him up now that I've been prepared by Tom Hartman. So
right.
I used the name Roy because I didn't actually want to use my real name, and I'm not using my real name now.
Yeah.
And one other guy got the question right about him asking what this policy he was talking about was with Social Security. Then he put me on the air next to this guy. And long story short, he asked me a question that basically started with, which political party did this and this and this? And he asked the other guy. The other guy said the Democrats. He came to me, and I said, I would say the Democrats, except that this whole thing has been debunked on Snopes. And he kind of got silent a little bit, and he said, yeah, well, the whole thing's a lie, huh? You're just kind of not really
yeah.
believing me.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I kind of said my piece, and it's a lot easier to scream and yell at him when you're, you know, not on the phone with him. So I said my piece.
Oh, good on you. Good on you, Deep Blue. I'm glad you did. And as I said, that thing is coming to an email box near you. It is flying all over the place. The right-wingers have been using it for years, and it's just amazing. Bruce, and thanks for the call. Bruce in Black Lake, New Mexico. About a half a minute here, Bruce, before we've got to wrap up this
hey,
hour.
Thanks.
What's up?
Thanks, Tom. You know, if the Democrats won a real disaster of an election, go for the draft. I mean, all respects to Charlie Rangel. He's great, but
oh, it'll never pass.
To promote a draft,
it'll never pass. And Charlie Rangel is like, you know, he's in a totally safe district, and he's like the little kid who said the emperor's wearing no clothes. He's out there speaking something that you know
well,
is
also,
the truth, but it's a political impossibility. I agree with
combat
you.
Combat troops don't matriculate to combat positions through a draft. It just doesn't happen.
Yeah, by and large, Bruce, I don't disagree. And you know, there's not been a draft historically, for example, for the Marine Corps and for the Air Force and things like that, for the Navy. But, you know, good point. 57 minutes past the hour. I've got to tell you about what happened when I signed up to go see Karl Rove tonight here in Portland. It should be interesting. It's our Everything Goes Friday. That and your calls when we come back right after the news.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and slightly unbalanced. This is Air America Radio.
Tom Hartman is excellent. He's bright. He's personable.
Tom Hartman on Air America Radio. Air America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program, defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
Well, it's Thomas Jefferson's birthday, and I promised you in the last hour, and then we'll get back to, it's also Anything Goes Friday, get back to your calls about any topic you want, any questions you may have, any issues you want to bring up. But I want to give you just one little quote, one short quote here from Thomas Jefferson. I don't have a soundbite from him, unfortunately, to share with you, although I understand that he had a rather high voice and was not a competent public speaker. In fact, he was so shy, he was painfully shy, over 6 feet tall, a skinny red-haired guy who was just painfully shy, and therefore his State of the Union address, his first address to Congress, he submitted as a written document and had somebody else, I believe it was James Madison, I could be wrong, read it for him, and many of his addresses, in fact. But in any case, our quote for the day from Thomas Jefferson, this is in 1800, he's running for president of the United States against John Adams, who was the sitting president, the second president, and the conservative president. Jefferson at the time was vice president of the United States, and he's running against Adams for the presidency. And Benjamin Rush, a friend of his, starts a conversation with him about religion in America, and specifically Christianity. And Benjamin Rush, like Jefferson, was a deist, and which is a whole other conversation. But in any case, this was 3 months before the election. In the letter, he says to Rush, please don't publish this letter until after the election, because it will, you know, but in any case, here's the letter. He says, dear sir, I promised you a letter on Christianity, which I have not forgotten, noting that he knew that the discussion, this would fuel the fire of electoral politics. He said, I do not know that it would reconcile the genus irritable vatum, that is the angry poets or the angry priests, who are all in arms against me. Their hostility is on too interesting ground to be softened. This is really an interesting point. So he describes what is the source of the hostility that the preachers are directing toward him. He said, the delusion on the clause of the Constitution, which, while it secured the freedom of press, covered also the freedom of religion. You know, he's talking about the First Amendment here. Had given to the clergy a very favorite hope of obtaining an establishment of a particular form of Christianity throughout the United States. And as every sect believes its own form to be the one true one, everyone perhaps hoped for his own, but especially the Episcopalians and the Congregationalists. The returning good sense of our country threatens abortion to their hopes. And they, the preachers, believe that any portion of power confided to me, such as being elected president, will be exerted in opposition to their schemes. And they believe rightly, for I have sworn upon the altar of God eternal hostility against every form of tyranny over the mind of man. But this is all they have to fear from me, but it is enough, too, in their opinion. End of quote. End of Thomas Jefferson. End of quote from Thomas Jefferson. Not the end. He actually won the election and went on to become the president for the next 8 years. And therein. So today, happy birthday, Thomas Jefferson. Bill in Oakland, California. Welcome to Anything Goes Friday. What's up?
Oh, my name is Bill. Am I on?
You are.
Oh, great. Hey, Tom, I've been trying about four different times. I thank you for hosting the Little Fox Theater. I was there. I got a couple of your books.
Well, thank
you. And today, I don't have the net. I don't have cable. I can't afford those. I find books are about the only source to get news deeper than the TV or papers. And I've loaned several of your books out to people at work. And I showed you a book called The Bush Agenda by Tonia Duhas.
Yes.
And I'd like to have you have her on. I've been trying since May. I went to several of her talks, two of her talks, and she just talked about the corporate media, corporate ownership in the U.S. and around the world taking over, you know, country by country.
Right.
That's kind of
right. Okay, The Bush Agenda by Antonio Yuhas. David is writing it down. We will we'll track it down, Bill. Thanks a lot for the call and for the heads up. John in Cape Cod, Massachusetts. Hey, John, I'm listening on WRL.
Hi, how are you, Tom? Great show as always. A couple of quick things. I
wanted to mention about Leo Strauss. I think you're right on with that. One thing, when you say that Bush doesn't really understand that, Strauss actually talked about that. He had a class of class of politicians that were to be sort of the useful idiots of the the ruling class. And so I think most of our politicians fall into that, and Bush certainly is no exception.
I don't think most of them, but I think many of them do.
Well, and I think maybe he kind of crosses the line a little because his family is sort of on the ruling class side.
I don't think his father is ignorant of these things.
Now, the other thing I want to mention...
In fact, frankly, I think that his father would have pushed back against the Straussians and did push back during his presidency. Even though I disagree with most of his father's policies, and I think he's an elitist and believes in imperial rule, he's not a neocon, and Bush is just and Junior has just willingly gotten into bed with these guys.
Absolutely, I think part of it is that Bush the Junior is kind of devoid of any kind of scruples or any kind of ideology himself, and he's just kind of an empty vessel that he's all about power. But I also wanted to mention quickly about Nancy Pelosi, and I think I have a suspicion about why the Bush administration is really going after her so strongly. And I think it may be a preemptive shot to try to stave off impeachment. I think, as we know, it's impeachment.
I think you're right. I think they're going after her because they're afraid of her, frankly.
Right. I think in kind of a backhanded way, what they want to do is make the public fear a Pelosi presidency so that there can be no support for removing Bush and Cheney.
Right. This is the advance immunization. They looked at what happened to Newt Gingrich, and that was not so much done to Newt by the Democrats, although they, Newt probably would argue with that, but I would say that it was done to Newt by Newt. But they looked at Newt Gingrich's speakership, which he eventually had to step down from because he was so unpopular, and they thought, okay, if we can make Pelosi as unpopular as Newt, if we can make people so afraid of her, then they will not want to see an impeachment action against Bush and Cheney because then you'd have President Pelosi. Good
right.
point, John, and well made. Scott in Gresham, Oregon. Hey, Scott, welcome to the program.
Hello, Tom. Welcome to Portland.
Oh, it's Scott Forrester.
Yeah,
used to work on this program. Hey, Scott.
Well, it's the first time I've called your national program. It's a pleasure.
Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, this czar, or I guess defense coordinator.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Robert Gates, Secretary of Defense, was on C-SPAN this week. I believe it was Wednesday. And he made reference to it, kind of rolled it out. But one thing that I keyed in on, and maybe you can do further expansion on this maybe next week, is that he mentioned Stephen Hadley. And maybe you could expand upon exactly
Hadley,
what
Rice's old number two. Or no, actually, he's currently her number two, isn't he?
Right. And he said, and this is a quote, Stephen Hadley can't do this full time in reference to this this czar position. And I'm paraphrasing, but he said, this war should not be fought by just the Defense Department and the State Department. So I really got the feeling that as opposed to what you said, that Bush is looking for a figurehead, I actually think that they're trying to take all the other agencies and departments of the U.S. government and have them be subservient and subordinate to the aims of the Department of Defense.
It's not inconceivable, Scott, or at least those two. I still think that Bush is just, he's tired of being commander-in-chief. He wanted to be the war president, then he decided he wanted to be the peace president. Now he doesn't know what he wants to be when he grows up. I think maybe he wants to retire, but he wants somebody else to be the war president, a.k.a. commander-in-chief, a.k.a. war czar. Mark in Florence, Oregon. Hey, Mark, just about three-quarters of a minute here before we got to wrap this segment up.
Hi, Tom. Merry Friday 13th to you.
Thank you. Happy Friday 13th to you, too.
And make the best of it. Tom, I have two questions for you. I'll try to make them very quick. And do you have knowledge of any ongoing congressional investigations concerning the massive amount of very well-documented evidence that the events of September 11th, 01, and the false and lying pre-war intelligence of the Iraq War originated with the current administration? Second question real quick.
Well, let me just answer your first question first. With regard to 9/11, I don't know of any ongoing congressional investigations, and I wish there were some, and I think all of us need to be calling our legislators at 202-225-3121 and saying we want an investigation.
Mm-hmm.
With regard to the latter, looking into how we got lied into this war, yes, absolutely, there are investigations into that going on in the House and the Senate. And again, encourage your members of Congress, of the House and the Senate, We want a serious accounting. We want to know how we got into this war. Thanks a lot for the call. 16 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you.
The Tom Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain. On Air America Radio. Call 866-303-2270.
Welcome back to Anything Goes Friday. By the way, join me in Dubrovnik, Croatia, June 3rd through the 9th for the conference put on by the Praxis Peace Institute. PraxisPeace.org is their website. It's called Transforming Culture from Empire to Global Community. Rianne Eisler, Tom Hayden, George Lakoff, David Corton, Francis Moore LePay, Swami Beyonananda. There's going to be a bunch of us there. And it's going to be a hoot, a lot of fun. We will be broadcasting this program in part live from there, from Dubrovnik, Croatia. And you're welcome to drop by. It's at praxispeace.org, P-R-A-X-I-S, peace.org, if you want more information. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. It's toll-free nationwide. And Dwayne in Mill Valley, California. Hey, Dwayne.
Hey, Tom, for your listeners who are interested in your concept of national service and supportive of it, I've just asked them to go to our website, www.worldservicecorps.us, and help us make it happen. It's not national, it's not a national draft, but it is volunteer service. And just three highlights. It ramps up over 7 years. It's congressional legislation. It's there at the website. By the seventh year, we'd have 1 million Americans voluntarily serving in their choice of many of the organizations you mentioned, Peace Corps, AmeriCorps, Habitat, Doctors Without Borders, so you could serve at home or abroad. And it does what you ask for in the sense that it gives you 2 years of community college tuition plus 2 years of state college tuition. And to attract those baby boomers and retirees, it gives the equivalent amount in medical savings or IRA savings deposits. And for those people with a little extra money, it gives them that equivalent amount in tax credits to incentivize them to go out and do this. And I, you know, if we could get some support from your listeners, we have a handful of representatives whose staffs we'll be meeting with in Northern California in the next several weeks, we expect, to talk about introducing this legislation. But we need this movement to pick up across the country. And if it does, it'll raise our public policymaking IQ while dealing with poverty and climate change and all the many problems we have.
Okay, Dwayne, you just gave it a great plug, so I wish you the very best on it. Aaron in Alaska. Hey, Aaron, welcome.
Yes, I'm 100% service-connected disabled Vietnam-era veteran for PTSD. Mm-hmm. I am very concerned about the returning veterans who are moving, who do actually get disabilities from the VA, who go to rural areas, because what's happening is they have a potential for having their care denied if they end up in hospitals, in emergency room in hospitals. There is a general exclusion in the VA that if they go in for mental health and end up in an emergency room, what's going to happen if they're put on a 72-hour hold because of suicidal thoughts, and they're committed, the VA will deny their care. It is an exclusion. It happened to me. It cost me $4,300 out of pocket. I can read the general exclusion. It says hospitals and outpatient care of a veteran it's only a line long. Veterans who is either a patient or an inmate of an institution other than a government agency, that agency has a duty to give care or services. In other words, the VA denies it. I fought this. I had it on appeal. I still lost. And I am 100% service connected for what it was. Any mental health patient who is far away from a Veterans Administration facility, even if you go in and mention in the emergency room that you're a veteran, and I walked into the facility, you can be denied care even if you're 100% service.
This is so wrong, Aaron. This is so wrong. And it speaks to three different issues. One is the fact that you know, the Veterans Administration does not have a broad dispersion of facilities around the country, and there's a lot of people who are far enough away that it's a real hassle for them to get to a veterans facility. facility if they need care quickly, number one. Number two, to the huge disparity in the way that we deal with physical illnesses versus mental illnesses, and the brain is just another organ, frankly, and particularly post-traumatic stress disorder. And number three, the whole issue of the Bush administration looking for ways to cut corners everywhere they can so they can have more tax cuts for millionaires and billionaires, and one of the corners that they're cutting is veterans.
That's exactly what's happened. And just think what's happening to all these young guys who are coming back, who are going to go back to Oklahoma or whatever and be 200 miles from the nearest VA facility, and they're going to have a suicidal thought and end up in emergency room, and what they're going to end up doing, even though they did get their service connection for PTSD, and they're going to find out they're going to get the bill for it.
Right. So once they show up
and
in a regular
the thing
hospital.
Is,
go ahead.
Yeah, and the thing is I, because I'm 100% service connected, I make too much money to have it paid for by state mental health funds.
In other words, your veterans' disability payments make you ineligible for local Medicaid. Oh man, what a bizarre catch-22. We really need to be talking to our members of Congress about supporting our veterans. Aaron, thank you so much for the call and for sensitizing our listeners to this. 27 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. We will be back with more of your calls. Anything Goes Friday in just a moment. Stick around. Listen carefully for your opportunity to support the advertisers who are keeping this program on the air.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
It's Anything Goes Friday, 34 minutes past the hour. David in Tukwila, Washington. You're live and on the air, David.
Hey, Tom. Hey, what I was calling about is the union down here. I think that's, I'm all for unions. That's a great thing that down here. They're not, the IWW is about one of my favorites. And this idea about, signing cards and becoming, union members is great. But there's a lot of unions out here that are not representative of the rank and files down here. The Teamsters Union have a union within a union called the Teamsters for a Democratic Union to try to straighten up that thing. The union there. They wouldn't even come out and pay people strike dues. They're taking CEOs out to, luncheons and golf trips. And I just think I want to try to find something more, something that can make unions more representative. And that's why I was
Go ahead.
But having like another card just signing out, if they're not representing me, I can just like sign the card and say, hey, you don't represent me, I'm not going to pay your dues. I think something like that would make them more representative. Because now if you don't like the union or if they're not representing you, you have to quit your job. You cannot not be in the union. And that's just kind of BS.
Unions are democratic institutions, David. They are unions are democracies. Unlike the workplace, which is a kingdom, it's a hierarchy. You have essentially a king. You have the CEO. You have a noble structure, and then you have the workers who are subject to the whims of the king. Unions are democratic institutions, and if the majority of the people in the union vote for the leadership of the union, that's the leadership of the union. Now, if it becomes corrupt, it's incumbent upon the members of the union to get rid of those corrupt those corrupt leaders. And I would suspect, and I don't have firsthand knowledge of this, but I looking back at Jimmy Hoffa, for example, back in the old days, that some of the more corrupt members of union leadership were getting a lot done for their members at the same time that they were being corrupt, and people were, winking and nodding the same way that they were in the wards in Philadelphia or in Chicago with Mayor Daley. In other words, it's possible to have democracy be corrupted. And that's one of the reasons that there does need to be a system of checks and balances, as it were. And there is with regard to unions. There are laws specifically, the RICO laws, for example. There are specific laws where unions, if they become corrupt, can be prosecuted, just like there are laws where governments, if they become corrupt, can be prosecuted. But the thing to keep in mind is that unions are democracies. And if everybody doesn't participate, you don't have a democracy. You don't have a union anymore, basically. And so, no, I disagree with you. I think, frankly, that we should roll back Taft-Hartley and go in the other direction. But the important point to remember is that unions are democratic institutions, and it's so easy to forget that, and the cons very much don't want you to know that. And it's one of the reasons why they're always pushing back against card check. This card check thing is a big deal, this legislation that will allow people to join unions anytime they want. Scott in Santa Clara, California. Hey, Scott, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Hey, listen, I just want to thank you for reminding us all that democracy is a product of progressive thinking, and that people like you and Joe Wilson go a long way to foster an age of reason and during a difficult time. And my reason for calling today is that nobody has been talking about the primaries being moved up to February. And it seems to me that it takes a lot more money to run a campaign when the primaries get moved up to such an early date. And yesterday on CNBC, there was a 6-minute piece about how much money corporate America is throwing into the Democratic Party, two times more than they did in 2006. So I'd just like to hear your take on the fact that the primaries have been changed to earlier dates, and what do you think that means in relationship to campaign funding? Thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot, Scott. I think the whole thing, the problem all started back with New Hampshire. And I used to live in New Hampshire. I lived there for 3.5-4 years. And that's, you know, when New Hampshire decided that they were going to get out ahead of everybody else and have an influence on the country, in my recollection of the history of it, and I may be wrong on this, but I don't think so, because maybe it's the urban legend that people who live in New Hampshire tell each other, because this is what I learned when I lived in New Hampshire, is that in part it was a consequence of the influence of some very powerful conservatives in New Hampshire, particularly Bill Loeb, who used to publish the Manchester Union Leader, and then his wife Nacky took on after him. And they used to, the front page of that paper always had a big editorial, a hardcore right-wing editorial, right smack dab on the front page every single day. It was the major newspaper in the state. And that it was a way of increasing conservative influence, particularly in the Republican Party. And, you know, getting out ahead. And the rest of the states said, we're not going to do this. You know, if we do this, it's going to screw everything up. It's going to create the situation that we're all looking at right now, which is that you end up with a candidate who has pretty much been nominated long before the nominating convention. Now, if you go back another 50 years, 60, well, actually go back maybe, 50, 60 years. It's not that far back. You find that the candidates were actually nominated at the conventions very often kind of in backroom deals where, you know, that wasn't always that desirable. It wasn't always that democratic. It was, you know, wheeling and dealing and who's got the best friends and who's willing to trade the best deals for whom. And that wasn't a system that worked. And so it was, okay, let's turn it over to the people. Let's have primaries. And then the primaries, well, New Hampshire gets out in front. And then Iowa came along and said, well, we're going to get out in front. We're going to make it an early primary. And then some of the southern states, South Carolina in particular, we'll get into this. And when it was just a few states, it was real manageable. But now if you get, you know, 5, 10, 15 states, or, in you know, California getting into it, states that represent, say, more than, in aggregate, more than a third or you know, something close to a half of the population of the United States, it's going to be all over. And I frankly think it's not a good thing, ultimately, for democracy. I don't think it's a good thing for the two-party system. I don't think it's good for our democratic institutions. And I agree with you. It's going to bring massive amounts of money into the campaign, and then you're going to end up with what, for all practical purposes, is going to be, you know, a year and a half long or a year-long campaign for President of the United States, or nearly a year-long, February to November, campaign for the presidency of the United States. 10-month campaign, I guess 11-month, when really it should be much shorter. In the United Kingdom, you cannot spend, if you're running for the House of Commons, you cannot spend more than £100,000, and nobody can on your behalf. If anybody spends any money on your behalf, it gets added into your total. £100,000, period. Now, we can't have a law like that here in the United States because the Supreme Court has ruled that limits on campaign spending violate the free speech protections of the First Amendment. But there has to be some way to negotiate these waters. And I frankly don't have the answer other than the possible, you know, possibly at the federal level saying that, you know, see, the federal government can't regulate states. They can't go to the states and say, you can or can't have a primary on a particular date, because they don't have that kind of power. You know, one of the points of the Constitution was to delegate, look at the Ninth and Tenth Amendments of the Constitution, to delegate all the power that's not specifically claimed for the federal government in the Constitution back to the states respectively and to the people. So the federal government can't say to the states, you can't have early primaries. But the federal government could say, any state that has a primary before, let's say, June or May, any state that has a primary, you know, before that is not going to be eligible for federal highway funds. I mean, there are tools that the federal government can use, and the states can say, okay, we don't need your federal highway funds. We'd rather have the $1 billion that's going to come into our state from advertising. But it seems to me if the federal government doesn't intervene in some way, that this competition among the states is going to get worse and worse and worse. You're going to have pretty much everybody eventually going to February primaries. And then you're going to have another New Hampshire step out and say, oh, well, you know, February is fine for everybody else, but we're going to go back to primaries in December of the previous year. And then you're going to have a 13-month, you know, and then everybody's going to move to that. And it's just going to get longer and longer and longer and more and more and more expensive. Now, the obvious solution beyond this is what Bernie Sanders was talking about, which is public funding of campaigns. If every taxpayer in the United States, all 100 million of us more or less, were to contribute $10, you know, check that box and make it a $10 box and no longer make it a box you can check, just make it mandatory. $10 from 100 million people, that's $1 billion. If you do that every year for 4 years, that's $4 billion. That's four times what will probably be spent in this electoral cycle. So we have the means for $10 per person. It's not even per person because it's just working people. I mean, it would be more like $10 per family. We have the means to have fully funded, publicly funded campaigns in the United States, and you can do that within constitutional limits. So I think looking at the example of what's going on in Arizona, what's going on in Maine, and frankly what's going on here in Portland, Oregon, we have a really good system in this city where if you can get 1,000 people to give you a $5 donation and sign a petition, which is a way of measuring, do you have grassroots support? Is this a serious candidate? Not is this somebody who was hatched in a backroom deal with a bunch of politicians, but is this a serious candidate? If you can get 1,000 people to give you $5 and sign a petition for your being on the ballot, you present that $5,000 and those 1,000 signed signatures, petitions, to the city, and the city gives you $100,000. And says, good luck on your campaign. And then if somebody runs against you and they put $150,000 into their campaign, the city gives you another $50,000. If they go to $175,000, the city gives you another $25,000. In other words, no matter what your opponent spends, the city matches it. And it's working really well in the city. And I think we can do something very much like that at the state and federal level. And I'd love to see that happening all across the United States. And I'd love to see some sort of a federal intervention. I mean, you know, the states need an intervention here. They're out of control. They're addicted to campaign money. Some sort of a federal intervention that would push all the primaries back to the point where we can have a little longer period of time to figure out who we want to be our candidates. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
Hey, thanks so much to Louise Hartman, David Poole, my producer, to Julian Suckman, and Lauren Kirshner and Air America Radio in New York, all the folks in New York who are helping make this program happen, to Sue Nethercutt and the folks in our chat room, to Michael Toth, who does our archives, Shelby and Ben at White Rose Society and RadioPower.org, and all the folks who, and to our sponsors, to our listeners, and to our affiliates for making this program possible. 9.5 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Richard in Vancouver, Washington. Hey, Richard.
Yeah, hello, Tom. I'm just a poor libertarian here in Vancouver, and it really frustrated me when I saw Maria Cantwell win the election. Maria Cantwell won, and Hillary Clinton won.
Well, I can understand. As a libertarian, you'd be very upset. They're Democrats.
I know, but I thought the Democratic Party was anti-war, and neither Hillary nor Maria Cantwell has come out, and for all I know, both of them are holding up the troop legislation.
But libertarians are not anti-war. Libertarians believe that basically the only function of government is to fight wars and have a police department.
Actually, libertarians believe in conflict. So, you must agree with
my
conflict,
point.
Too.
My point.
Because what conflict brings out the best in people.
See, and I disagree. I don't think so. I think cooperation brings out the best in people. And that's why I call libertarians Republicans who want to smoke dope and get laid. And I think that that's the fundamental difference between liberals and conservatives. And libertarians are extreme conservatives.
And Democrats and Republicans are serious, right? So also I want to find out about the progressive liberal business.
Sure.
I don't know if I'm just creating this out of thin air, but progressives believe in capitalism, but they do not believe in corporatism. They hate corporatism. And
that's a really good question, Richard.
I have never heard you express anything in support of capitalism, the free exchange of goods and services.
Oh, you haven't? Well, you haven't listened very carefully. I am a supporter of regulated capitalism, and I am the beneficiary of it. I've started 7 companies in my life, and I've made a fair amount of money doing it. And we've sold off most of them and profitably. I've retired 4 times in my life for a couple of years at a time, and our kids have traveled all over the world as a consequence of that. And we've had a pretty good life, a pretty good run as a result of, actually, I'd say, free enterprise rather than capitalism, because I never went to a venture capitalist to start my businesses. We basically started them all from scratch. But I'm a big believer in free enterprise, and I'm not an opponent of capitalism. I think, however, that it should be subordinate to the needs of society. That is to say, if I go into a business that is toxic to society, destructive to society, that society has not just the right but the obligation to say, no, you can't do that. On the other hand, if I operate within the bounds that are useful to society, that is, I'm producing, you know, a product that for which there is a demand and I'm making a profit doing it, you know, whatever that is, that's my own business, and I don't think society should be sticking its nose into it. So there you go. Antonio in Gonzales, California. Hey, Antonio, what's up?
Hey, Tom. You have an awesome show, and thanks for all you do. Well, one of the things I wanted to talk about today was I truly believe in my heart that once Bush is out, I think we'll see a not necessarily an end to Fox News, but, you know, less noise power. And the reason why is, you know, the recent news that Obama and Clinton won't be participating in some of their sponsored debates. And
Fox is already in free fall in their ratings. It's been going on for about a year and a half.
And the whole IMUS thing now that I think all of us, a lot of Americans,
I think the culture of hate in this country is starting to crumble.
We're done with hate talk and personal attacks. That's my opinion. And I hope that is the case. That way we get our news back.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you, Antonio, and this is what I was talking about a couple of days ago, and I said, you know, this whole IMUS thing, what we really need to be talking about is the cultural consensus, not who should be regulating what and not whether or not it's the free market or anything. There is no such thing as a free market to start out with, at least not in the United States. But that said, I think that what we're seeing is a change in the cultural consensus, and that's a good and healthy thing, and we are the cultural consensus. What we're seeing is that the parade is going in another direction, or that the majority of decent Americans are stepping forward and saying, I'm going to be part of the parade, and both politicians and some of our companies are saying, okay, we'll get out in front of that parade, and it's a good thing. Antonio, thanks for the call. Jeff in Tacoma, Washington. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Tom. I just wanted to tell all your listeners that calling Congress works. I followed your lead on this. I've put Congress's phone number on my cell phone so that every time you or any other host mentions an issue that we need to call Congress, I get on the phone, I talk to them, and it doesn't just push them in a direction. It also educates their staff, and it also makes me feel good. So I'd like to encourage everybody to do that. One thing I did do today was to call Senator Bingaman's office, who's the head of the Energy Committee,
mm-hmm.
and try to find out why we still haven't found out what was discussed at the Energy Task Force meetings. And I'd love for people to follow up on that. I know the Supreme Court ruled, but there's got to be another way to find out if Dick Cheney was told to invade Iraq by those oil companies.
Yeah, well, the Supreme Court actually ruled that Dick Cheney eventually has to divulge that information, that he just didn't have to do it before the election of 2004. And so we'll
see. So the staff has it wrong, so everybody should call.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And the telephone number for Congress is 202-225-3121. 202-225-3121. Jeff, thanks for the call. Robert in Bronx, New York. Hey, Robert, just a half a minute here before we've got to wrap up the show.
Okay, thank you very much, Tom. Enjoy your show. The reason the Bronx is called the Bronx is because there was a family that owned a large farm in the Bronx. It was called, and they were the Bronx family. So that's why it's called Bronx.
Okay. And thanks for that.
And I'm just curious about what's going on with the Caroline investigation now that she's been dismissed. What's going on?
To the best of my knowledge, all of her investigations, including the investigation of Congressman Jerry Lewis and the investigation of Karl Rove's involvement with Duke Cunningham, have all been stopped. The person who has followed her, the prosecutor who was installed by the Bush administration, has stopped all of Carol Lamb's investigations. Now, if I'm incorrect on that, somebody let me know, but I'm quite sure I'm not. Coming up Monday on the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio, I'll be challenging conservative Nicholas Kipnis about the embryonic stem cell research. He says it's a deceptive bill. Rhianne Eisler is here on her new book, The Real Wealth of Nations. That and the rest of the news and your calls. And remember, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. Have a great weekend.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.